This is Colorado Matters at the Tattered. I'm Ryan Warner. Wars over water get really, really ugly in the new novel, The Water Knife. Science fiction writer Paolo Bacigalupi, who lives in Paonia, sets his book in the West, in the not-too-distant future, and it's a tale of two cities. Las Vegas's cup runneth over, thanks to a cunning, cutthroat water manager, while Phoenix has run dry and feels positively apocalyptic, all with climate change in the background. Paolo Bacigalupi is a National Book Award finalist for his young adult novel, The Shipbreaker. His 2009 debut, The Wind-Up Girl, landed him a slew of awards, including a Nebula for science fiction. And let's welcome him to the Tattered Cover Bookstore.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us, Paolo.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Before we talk about characters, I want you to paint us a picture of what life is like in this novel. A person's quality of life depends on whether they're a water have or have not. So let's say I'm lucky enough to have water. I'm likely living in something called an arcology. What is an arcology? How do the water haves live?
Okay, so an arcology is an essentially nearly self-contained living structure. It's I'm really interested in the idea of buildings and living environments that recycle everything that they can, that recycle all their waste, that grow food off of their waste, that recycle all of their water, that reprocess it again and again, things like that. So that the arcologies are built to really bring things into them but not let very much leave them. And so people can live their entire lives inside of them. They have food, they have recreation, they have entertainment, they have their jobs. And arcologies in the story of The Water Knife have been built because the environment outside is becoming more and more unfriendly. And so it's more and more reasonable to sort of try to keep everything inside.
And these have basically replaced the suburbs because suburbs have desiccated. In Phoenix, for instance, they can't provide water to all of these homes that have sprawled out.
Right.
So people are sort of building up and in.
Yeah.
If they have the means.
Right. The water haves are consolidating. Or actually, maybe the best way to describe it is that the haves are consolidating around water. The have-nots can't afford to buy into an ecology. They can't pay the rent. They can't get the entrance fees. And, you know, the interior of an arcology, the whole way I just thought of it in my own head was that it would be full of waterfalls, hanging gardens. And then outside of those places, out in those suburbs, out in those places where the water has been turned off, all you have is, you know, the occasional coyote running between the suburban houses that are completely empty and dry and are useless now that they don't have any water coming out of their taps. One of the things that really strikes me about development is that you can have all sorts of wonderful amenities. You know, you can have granite countertops. You can have 3.5 baths. You can have all sorts of wonderful things. And as soon as you stop being able to put water into the house and take water out of the house, as soon as your toilets don't flush and your taps don't work, that house is valueless, and that beautiful granite that you paid so much for to put on a countertop is just a hunk of rock.
And tens of thousands of these are sitting empty
right. In
the world you've created. Why don't we have you read a description from the book of a dust storm? So this is a sense of what people are living with when they're not in an arcology.
The storm intensified. Day turned to night. Sand and grit beat against the windows, shaking them. Conversations were muttered and desultory, oppressed by the raging elements outside. Most of them were out of Phoenix, trying to get somewhere else. Some of them had passes that would get them into Nevada or else California, some all the way to Canada. All of them were wistful for what they were leaving behind. All were desperate for the place ahead to be better. A cascade of electronic chimes signaled the storm's abatement as data packets finally pried between the dust motes and found their way to the phones of their owners. People murmured relief that the storm hadn't turned out to be a big one. They smiled at one another and felt lucky as the waitresses rang up their tickets.
Immigration winds up being a big theme in this book because the lack of water in light of climate change has just created all these new patterns. And people who want to go where the water is and the people who don't want them in their backyards.
Right. We cluster around areas that are supportive of us. And one of the things you notice about development in the West is you only find towns right next to springs or right next to rivers. And so in this future that I was sort of looking at, where so many things are destabilized by climate change, where whole towns are drying up, where the land can't support people or cattle or food, where huge hurricanes are smashing up against the Gulf Coast, where seawalls are falling and the coasts are flooding in some cases, you know, in all of those cases, it's putting people on the move. They're all hunting for some better place than where they're at. And all of the states that have more stability are like, no, that's a few too many refugees for us, thanks. And so they all start setting up their own sort of border patrols, and they all start locking down their borders. And there's sort of a very aggressive sort of states' rights movement going on, where the federal government is weak and staggering around trying to help the refugees, and the states are all sitting there going, not inside of my territory, they aren't coming here.
Water in this world has become a highly tradable commodity, much more like a stock. And even the pumps reflect this in your book.
Yeah. So in Phoenix, there are pumps that have been put into the ground by the Red Cross and Chinese philanthropic organizations. And they're sunk down in these aquifers below Phoenix, so they can pump up water. But there's a limit to how much water can be pumped up. And so all of the wells that have been sunk are price controlled. And so they monitor the depth of the aquifer, and they set the price of water accordingly. And so when the aquifer is low, the price of water goes up. When the water is high, the price of water goes down. And so it's a very free market system, right? And so it ensures that nobody undervalues water. On the other hand, what it means is that if you're too poor, you can only afford a cup of water. And somebody who's rich can afford gallons and gallons and gallons and gallons and gallons. You know, there's a saying actually in the West that water flows towards money. And this is very much that.
You mentioned the Chinese. They wield enormous power in this story.
Yeah. In my mind, a lot of the story is really about people who plan and look ahead and people who don't. There's a contrast between Las Vegas that planned and Phoenix that didn't, and they're very different sort of outcomes. But there's also a big contrast between the United States that didn't plan and didn't anticipate and China who did. And so you're sort of seeing this widening gap of prosperity also based on whoever's planning and building and thinking ahead versus those people who are getting smacked upside the head by the changing circumstances.
I promise we're going to get to the characters next, but I'm fascinated by just how much thought you've given to the details of this world, which really is set possibly within our lifetimes, fair to say.
No, yeah, no, it was deliberately near future, yeah.
The clue to me in the book that it's within our lifetimes is at one point you talk about Britney Spears being a grandmother.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, okay.
A hot grandmother.
A hot grandmother.
So terrible. I was so bad. Cut all of that.
Wait, no. We're not cutting any of that. But that's how you place us in time. But I do wonder, before you write, do you create a blueprint of your fictional world, or do those details emerge as you're writing?
The details typically emerge as I'm writing and even in rewrites. I did want this to be a very near future feeling story. I wanted it to feel like a story that could be happening to any of us. And so I didn't want it to feel too futuristic. I didn't want everybody with cyber implants or anything. I didn't want us to be distanced from those characters and their stories. But there were sort of details that I did want to have in the story that would help the reader understand both what's going on in the world, but also that it does give you that little taste of like, oh yeah, this isn't this year, this isn't next year, but it could be 5 years. And so like something like the clear sacks was sort of like that.
Yeah, describe the clear sacks. So they're ubiquitous.
Okay, so these clear sacks are a cheap water filtration device, basically. They're basically a plastic bag that people can pee into, and then you can squeeze the plastic bag and filter out the impurities, and you have water again. And so it's a super cheap way for poor people to be able to drink their own pee. That's disgusting, right? But it's also world building. I mean, it tells you a lot about exactly where people are in the world. It tells you how desperate they are. And it also tells you how we tend to solve problems with technology. You know, we solve it and we say, oh, people are thirsty. Here's this, cheap plastic thing that you can use. In the story, these plastic bags, they're multi-use, but you can't use them forever. So they go bad, basically, and then people throw them away, and then these clear sacks are blowing around on the streets because there's no trash pickup anymore. And so then the clear sacks are getting tangled up in the saguaro cactus, and they're getting hung up on the Ocotillo. And so you sort of see this, pseudo-solved problem that also then, you know, you learn about drought, you learn about poverty, you also learn about the physical landscape of Phoenix, and one detail then goes a long way towards building out a sense of a lived-in world. ClearSex actually came much later in the story. They were not in an initial draft at all.
Oh, I see, part of a rewrite.
And as I was going back, I was like, I want this to feel more weird. And I was like, what can I do? And I was like, ClearSax, that's what it's going to be. And then I worked with the name for a while before I came up with one that sounded just gross enough.
You wanted weird, and you thought, I'll have characters drink their own urine. Right. I think you got there.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
For the win.
So the title of this book, The Water Knife, refers to a man named Angel Velasquez. And he's a badass. What is a water knife?
Water knives are sort of the 007s of water, basically. They work for Las Vegas, and Las Vegas has these agents that they send out to give someone an offer on their water rights that they can't refuse, or they're the ones who go out and blow up someone else's water treatment plant so nobody else can pump out of the river. They're the people who get it all done. And Angel is Catherine Case's lead water knife. He's the guy who always gets the job done.
And Case is a very savvy water manager who has managed to keep the taps running in Vegas.
Right, yeah. She's the water manager for Vegas, and she's probably the person with the most foresight in the entire story. She's the one who sort of looked around and sort of said, wow, we have terrible water rights. We are a city in a desert, and we desperately need our water, and we don't have enough. So how are we going to get that? And she started planning and making moves to make sure that happened, and one of those things was to hire a bunch of water knives. And, Angel is also a thug. He's sort of a refugee himself. He's originally fled out of Mexico from the cartel states down there and has fled north and then sort of got tangled up with Catherine Case, and she was essentially salvation for him, that he could live in an arcology in return for just doing a bunch of leg breaking was the best deal that he'd ever been offered.
I'd like to have you read a little of Angel's impressions when he visits Phoenix. Okay. So again, Phoenix, bone dry. He's coming from Vegas, where water is still running.
Everything looked worse than the last time Angel had been here. More dilapidated, dust-covered businesses, more broken glass, more abandoned shopping plazas and strip malls, PetSmart, Parties to Go, Walmart, Ford dealerships, all standing empty, glass shattered and gutted. Women on the corners, boys in tight pants waving down cars at intersections, leaning in, doing whatever they needed to get a little money, to buy a little water, to keep going for another day. If Angel wanted, he guessed he could pick up someone for the cost of a meal, a bath, maybe a chance to clean their clothes in his hotel tub. $10? $20 to tip?
People will prostitute themselves, essentially, for water. And you have another character who does that.
Yeah, another character is Maria Villarosa and her friend Sarah, and they're Texas refugees. They fled out of Texas when Texas fell apart, and, you know, Arizona has no love for Texas refugees. And so Maria's friend Sarah is a prostitute, and eventually Sarah sort of pulls Maria into her world.
As this chaos grows in Phoenix, so does a form of journalism you call the blood rags, which document the carnage of the water wars. And another central character in your book is an investigative journalist named Lucy Monroe. The gruesome murder of her friend leads her to what could be the biggest story of her career. Heck, it would probably be one of the biggest stories in history.
Right.
What can you say about it without...
Without spoilers?
Exactly.
Right. So Lucy is a character who, she's a very hardened journalist, and she's been documenting sort of the collapse of Phoenix for about the last 10 years. And she started out as sort of an outsider watching this and sort of laughing at all the sad, stupid Phoenix people as they're going through their collapse. And one of the terms that people use for the kind of work that she does is collapse pornography. You know, the writing about broken places, the taking the photos of the terrible gutted buildings. And there's a sort of a modern equivalent of that is like the fetishistic photography that we do of Detroit sometimes. You know, pornographic interest in how things fall apart. And she started out very much on the outside, but has slowly become sort of embedded in Phoenix life and has made friends in Phoenix and has become somewhat a part of the fabric of that city. And one of her sources and contacts and sort of friends is this guy, Jamie. And Jamie works in the Phoenix Water Department. And Jamie has become convinced that he's found a game changer for Phoenix, something that will allow Phoenix to have all the water it would ever need and that would flip the power dynamics of the entire Colorado River. And then he winds up dead.
The idea for this book about climate change and water scarcity came from a couple of places, as I understand. You were online editor at High Country News for a time and worked with a lot of smart journalists covering water there. But the gasoline on the fire was a trip you took to Texas.
Yeah. So this was in 2011, and I went. I was down there for a science fiction convention, actually. And it turned out I was in the middle of this pretty apocalyptic drought. And it was really interesting because you were seeing all of these effects of a major drought on the state. You were seeing farmers that were having to put their cattle down because the land couldn't support them. You were seeing crops that weren't going to grow for their full season, towns that were running out of water. You were also seeing weird things like there were rolling brownouts because there wasn't enough water in the reservoirs to generate hydroelectricity. And I myself actually got heat stroke when I was down there. And that probably led to sort of my delirious rage at the whole thing. But a friend of mine, she just looked at me and she was like, you need to go in this swimming pool now. And, of course, this strange thing is, like, in the middle of a drought, you also have a swimming pool. And, you know, 30 minutes later, I sort of came back to myself and I was like, wow, like, I think I was crazy. And she said, you were. And it was, like, a strange thing to see that heat, you know, have that huge human toll on you.
Well, so was this book written out of delirium?
Yeah, pretty much. The thing that stood out to me was that this is a terrible drought. And then the thing that stood out to me was this looks an awful lot like most of the climate models say the future will be. So if I feel like I'm standing in a drought, and droughts are that, you know, that passing event that just happened to come by and sort of knock us on our butt for a second, but then we get up and we go on with our lives. If this is actually the future, then what I'm doing right now while I'm delirious in Texas is I'm time traveling. I've actually just jumped in a time machine and I've gone to the future. And how does it look? And the answer is it looks scary as hell. And that was really striking to me. But the thing that was sort of like the icing on the cake was that at the same time as I was sort of looking at this drought, Rick Perry was a viable presidential candidate. And he was going around holding prayer circles and praying for rain. And that really struck me because, you know, you're saying like you think, okay, so all of the data says we're headed towards more life like this. And the leadership, the respected leadership in this state and also in some ways in the nation is involved in magical thinking. And this does not lead to a good outcome. You know, if we're gonna win the future, we actually have to believe that the future exists, that it's coming at us. And this guy clearly doesn't. And by extension, that means our democracy also doesn't. And so that was the moment when I really started thinking about wanting to write about a place that engages with reality and faces it and deals with it, like Las Vegas does in the story, and a place that lives in denial, like Phoenix.
In the book, a religious sect has emerged called the Mary Perrys.
Yeah.
Is that related? And is that Rick Perry?
You know, I just wanted to give him credit where you know, credit is due. The Mary Perrys are these crazed religious sect people who sort of go around doing tent revivals and always are saying that rain is coming as they sort of self-flagellate themselves. And yes, that is very much, Rick really inspired me.
I want to ask you a really pointed question. We're living with the effects of climate change now. We read about them every day or hear about them on the radio. It can be really depressing. What makes you think people want to read a novel about all this stuff?
Heck, if I know, I wouldn't. I don't know. Like, I like romantic comedies. Like, go on.
Well, in this way, this is not
sure.
An escapist novel in the least, unless what you hope to escape
right.
to is more doom.
Some of the characters come out okay-ish. No. So the thing I think about this is, you're right. Like, I mean, there is bad news. And what I notice is that people don't like to read those stories. They don't like to read those news stories. I notice that if I've got a choice in the newspaper about where I'm going to go in the pages, well, which would I rather read about? You know, Apple's new iWatch or whatever the heck it is, or would I rather read about, you know, more devastating drought in California? Let's see. You know, we have a natural instinct to go towards things that are comforting. We have a natural instinct to want to be inside of a safe narrative or a happy narrative. the thing that I feel like I want to do with my stories is I want to give people a ripping ride, a thriller, an experience, like an immersive experience that is a genuine entertainment. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that what I'm aiming to do is entertain, flat out. If I'm not entertaining my readers, I don't know why I would be writing fiction. But that said, you know, as long as you're being entertained, I can also throw in all these details that you might have skipped in the newspaper. And hopefully that those details stick in a way that maybe in the newspaper, either because we didn't read it, it didn't matter, or because it's not exactly contextualized. And that's the other thing that I sort of like about writing science fiction particularly, is that science fiction gives us this opportunity to contextualize the present. When we look at some photograph of something like Lake Mead or Lake Powell, which are low right now, if you look at a photograph of one of those giant reservoirs, there's nothing about that photograph that says apocalypse. They're gorgeous photos. You know, you've got blue sky, you've got white bathtub ring, you've got red rocks, you've got blue water. I mean, these things pose themselves really nicely. And so, you know, that means, though, that we aren't actually gathering all of the data that we need in order to understand our present world and our future world. And so when I write something like The Water Knife, where, you know, Lake Mead is even lower, where all of the states are fighting over water, where there are real human consequences, and where, you know, we as readers then get to sit inside of the skin of a climate refugee. We get to, like, fight the battles of a water knife. We get to report on the tragedies that the reporter is reporting on. Then we can experience those things viscerally and see them viscerally. And ideally, that means that the next time that we pick up the newspaper and we see a news story, that that's contextualized in a different way, because we've lived in the skin of the future.
You clearly have a great capacity for imagining the worst. And I imagine that serves you.
I'm sorry.
No. That has to serve you very well as a fiction writer, and especially science fiction. But how does that affect your life outside of writing? In other words, are you a very anxious person?
I am an anxious person. And the reason why I write the stories that I write is because I'm purging anxieties. If I'm reading certain pieces of news, if I'm looking at certain details about the present and the path that we seem to be moving, that fills me with anxiety. And so being able to write a story that sort of delineates those anxieties also means that I can sort of set them aside.
It's cathartic.
Yeah, very much. But that also means that once I've written it there, then I can still have a life here.
So you'd be a very unpleasant person if you weren't writing.
Oh, no, I actually was. No, I was a terrible person when I wasn't writing. Yeah, no, you can ask my wife. She's out there. I'm anxious, depressed, and generally horrible. And it's one of the reasons why when I was a failure as a writer years ago, I'd been writing novels, and every novel would fail, and then I'd try to write another novel, and that one would fail, and I wrote a lot of novels. And, you know, there was a point where I was thinking about giving up writing because I clearly was not able to make it, and I never would. And the thing that brought me back to it actually was that I am a happier, more centered person when I write. And so I decided, well, you know, maybe I'll never have a career at this. Oh, well, I still like the act of writing.
There are some really violent scenes in the book. We've intimated that already. A character, and if you're sensitive to this stuff, this would be a time to turn the radio off, but only for a moment. A character has her fingers eaten off by hyenas. Another character is another character is dismembered. It's really hard to read for me. Is it hard to write?
A little bit sometimes when I like the character and I suddenly realize that the most reasonable thing, the world is harsh, and so there are certain things that when you want to protect your character, but at the same time you want your character to live in this world that you've created, and that world has rules, and you can only protect your character so much, and so if they end up in a stupid place at a stupid time doing a stupid thing, something bad will happen to them, and it does, and that is a little unnerving. The story is violent. Frankly, it's actually far less violent than most of the source material that I use to get a bead on what I want to do with the story.
So grow a spine, Ryan. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. No,
okay.
No, no.
Good.
Yeah. In the nicest possible
way. In the nicest possible way. You get a positively cataclysmic at points, and I'll just reading from the book, maybe in 1,000 years, everyone will be living underground with only greenhouses touching the surface. Maybe in 1,000 years, humanity would become a burrowing species, safely tucked underground for survival. I say this to ask a question about your son.
Who's out there right now.
Who's in our audience. If you can imagine such a bleak world, why have a child?
Arjun, I just want you to know I love you and I'm really happy to have you. Why have a child? I think, honestly, it's not quite like that. It's that you have a child and then you realize what you're giving him, that you only have the sense of responsibility after you have the child. Before then, I think having children is almost a pretty specific and selfish act. It's really about you. It's about you thinking, oh, wouldn't it be nice if there was another me running around? Oh, wouldn't it be nice if there was another of my wife running around? That would be great. Let's make one of those. And that's all ego-driven. And then you actually have your child and you realize the responsibility you hold towards that person who turns out is neither you nor your wife and actually depends on you for all good things. Mostly what having a child does is it gives you a sense of pressure. You can reflect on yourself day in and day out. Does this actually make my child's life better? You know, is he going to thank me in 30 more years? Will I have done the right thing by him? And I think that equation used to be a lot simpler. It used to be just if you earned enough money so you could send your kid to college that you would have done right by your child or whatever. And now I think that we have another set of responsibilities, and you feel those more strongly, especially when you're working in the spaces that I work in for my writing.
And so do you think that your writing is of service, or do you hope it's of service and that somehow benefits your child beyond the bottom line?
I mean, well, yeah, I mean, and also, I mean, if you're going to, you know, whack down a bunch of trees and turn them into books, like, you sort of hope that the books do something good for the world. I mean, there is, I mean, you, I don't know, like, I mean, this might just be from my hippie upbringing or something, but, you know, my parents sort of, you know, unfortunately inculcated a lot of sense of social responsibility in me, and that's, you know, it's a total pain in the neck. I actually tried to sell out. That was my first rebellion, was really desperately trying to sell out. I went to work in China in business, and it was really hard for me. I didn't have it in me.
You make many references in The Water Knife to the real-life book, really celebrated work of nonfiction called Cadillac Desert.
Yeah.
And Mark Reisner wrote it in 1986 about disappearing water in the West. And it becomes pivotal in your story. I'll leave it at that. What impression did Cadillac Desert have on you?
When I was growing up, actually, Cadillac Desert was one of those books that was on the shelf of people I knew. If you were an intellectual or if you were somebody who worked in resources in the West or if you were, you know, it all connected to sort of Western thinking. I think that, you know, there was a Reisner book that would be sitting there, Cadillac Desert, which is the strangest title of all time. And so my first experiences of it were really as a child looking up at spines of books and seeing this particular book and what is that thing. But I think that when I read it, the thing that really stood out to me was, you know, there's all of this wisdom here, and it clearly has had actually no effect on us whatsoever. And that's sort of this troubling thing. But the Reisner, really, I feel like he laid out so much about our relationship with water in the West, and he laid out so much about our relationship with our techno-obsession with dam building and with being able to pipe water here and there and to create prosperity where it had never been, to make the desert bloom. All of these things are narratives of power and success and
dominance over nature.
Right, and control of nature. We as human beings know better than nature. And to a certain extent, you can win at that. And then there's this moment where, well, maybe nature slaps us back. And he pointed a lot of fingers towards those danger points. And then we continue to develop even more in the same spots that, you know, he's saying, this is stupid. This is dumbest project ever. Another dumb project. Another project that would only have been funded with federal pork.
Let's talk just a little bit about the science fiction label, because I, in reading this book, thought it might put you in a box a bit. But this is based on all kinds of assumptions, I suppose, I have about science fiction. I think that if you say to someone, oh, this is a work of science fiction, they immediately picture...
Barbarella.
Barbarella, sure. I was going to go with Space Odyssey, but
rocket
sure.
ships, blasters, Barbarella.
Barbarella.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, robots and... Yeah. But that's sure. so not this book.
Yeah, this is. I think this is the difference. You know, when I use the symbol words science fiction, what those symbol words mean to me, and what those symbol words are going to mean to someone else. Science fiction is a word that sort of morphs as it travels almost from one person's lips to another person's head. And I feel like it is frustrating sort of because I will tell people I write science fiction and the first thing they say is, oh, I don't read that. And you're like, ow. Thanks. I'm sorry. I hate you. But then if you say, oh, well, actually, with this book, I'm writing about drought in the Southwest. I'm writing about a water war between Phoenix and Las Vegas as the Colorado River runs dry. And then the person is like, oh, yeah, we had this terrible drought back in, whenever. And they remember a drought, and it was terrible, and they remember all sorts of details. So, wow, that sounds like a really interesting book. You're like, it's science fiction. But, so what I found is that, depending on who I'm talking to, I will change, how I describe it. Is it a post-apocalyptic book? If it'll help you read the book, yes. Is it a dystopian book? If it'll help you read the book, yes. Is it a science fiction book? Yes. Whatever you need it to be on the outside so you'll pick it up and actually read it and see what's actually on the inside, I will totally agree. because those labels that we use that, sort of are handy in the shorthand are really limiting otherwise.
I thought we'd wrap up with a question about a recent blog post on your website, windupstories.com. And the title of the post was, "When People Hate You and or Your Writing." Quoting here, "If you're a writer, you're going to run into a lot of people who don't like you, who don't like your work, who don't like your values, or the values they think you represent." Has this been your experience? That you nodded yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, this is the experience of every writer at some point. Anyone who has the audacity to actually say, to the world, I exist, hello, here I am, is immediately a magnet for the attacking crows, if you will.
Are you getting better at dealing with that?
No. No, actually, I'm still working very hard to deal with that. I think there's a bunch of things that are really interesting to me right now about the state of being an author, actually, and a lot of those have to do with things like social media. The relationship between the writer, the reader, and the general populace is much tighter and closer and stranger than it used to be. I can open up my Twitter feed and see somebody say, well, I can't decide who's more overrated, Paolo Bacigalupi or Ann Leckie. And they've tagged both of us. It's like, well, thank you so much for sharing that today. That was a wonderful little warm-up for the morning for me. A friend of mine's comment was, well, neither is as overrated as this tweet. But there it is. I mean, there's a casual level of sort of like social violence that goes on in social media all the time. And that's just kind of like, it seems to apparently be the acceptable water that we're swimming in at the moment. I think we're still learning how to actually be human on the internet. But there's other stuff where, somebody will say, oh, I've decided because you write about climate change, you're another one of those damn liberals who needs to be, strung up on the fence line. Or, just because you've written about some character who's a minority, you're either a racist because you wrote the character wrong, or you're, an apologist of, minorities because you decided to put brown people in your story at all, and so now we're going to attack you for that. There's always stuff that's going on where somebody's got some kind of drum they want to beat, and the best drum that they can find is your head. And that's kind of, it's part of the game, apparently. It's not much fun.
Joe Sinise, Denver. In all of your work, at least all of it that I've read, you talk about some post-apocalyptic or not even apocalyptic dystopia. Do you see any hope to avoid this? Anything that can be done? Or if we continue the same route we're on, is it inevitable that we at some point go over the cliff?
Yeah, there's a lot of hope. I mean, we as human beings have a huge capacity to organize. We have a huge capacity to change almost anything about our lives. And in fact, we have. We've had everything from political revolutions to technological revolutions. We have a massive capacity to change. We have a massive capacity to look around and say, we don't like this. We want something better. Will we do that? That is the question. Most of my stories are tragedies because there are stories where we all sat around and just kind of wrote it out and sort of went, oh, well, you know, maybe someday it'll get fixed by someone. I hope Elon Musk comes to save us. And that's the direction of failure. The things that are troubling to me right now really are that we do seem to have, specifically in the United States, actually, difficulty engaging with reality. We have difficulty understanding that climate change is real. We have difficulty understanding that there is data out there that is not actually some sort of a religious argument, but it is simply data telling us we're going in a certain direction. The fact that the United States has such a difficulty assimilating real data, it impairs our problem-solving capacity quite a lot. And that worries me a lot.
Hi, Sid Wilson from Denver. Was your character, Catherine Case, is she based on Pat Mulroy in Las Vegas? And if she is, how does she react to her?
Shh, don't tell her. Yes, absolutely. Patricia Mulroy is without question a huge inspiration for me. Catherine Case is sort of Patricia Mulroy 4.0. More serious, more hardcore, more absolute in the way that she's solving problems.
And let me say, Catherine Case is the water manager who has managed to keep the water going in Las Vegas.
Right. And Patricia Mulroy, similarly, is exactly that person. And she did amazing things for the Southern. She consolidated the Southern Nevada Water Authority. You know, she's the person who put out the water bounties on lawns in Las Vegas. Like, said, I'm going to pay you money to rip that lawn out right now. We're going to kill lawns, and we're going to pay you to do it. She was really no nonsense, and she did a great job of also negotiating with the rest of the interest groups on the Colorado River to make sure that Las Vegas had extra protections. They can pump for every gallon of water that they put back into Lake Mead. They can pull another gallon out. Those are things that, like, she negotiated and she was involved in. And so she's always been this really iconic figure to me in terms of being somebody who is entirely reality-based.
Hello, I'm Hayden Ringel, and I live in Denver, Colorado. And based on your personal experience, what is your advice to people who are writing their first novel?
Start it and finish it. And that's not a joke. I mean, this is whenever you start a story, you always think it's going to be cool and you're really excited about it. And then about halfway in or a quarter of the way in or a third of the way in or whatever it is, you suddenly realize it's the dumbest idea in the world. But you've just come up with this new amazing idea over there, and it would be so much better if you just go over and write that. Don't do that. Stick with the story that started out interesting and became dumb and keep going with it. Finish it. Make it good. You know, and when you say finish it, it means write it through to the very end and then look at it and say, well, what can I do to make this even more better than it was? More better. And in the end, for me, the way that I defined being done with a story, whether that was a short story or a novel, was that I would send it out to be rejected. And that's a really hard thing, but it's that final step of I finished it, and now I will submit it to other people to, you know, and they will do the judging of it. I will not hold it in a trunk. I will not keep it hidden. And even if they reject it, that's fine, but that's their job. I actually finished it by sending it out and submitting it. And while that's getting sent out, the next thing you do is you go write another novel. And the thing that, you know, the other thing that I would say is that I wrote 4 novels before my 5th novel finally succeeded. So 4 times I wrote novels, and I thought they were really good, and I got rejected with them. And every single novelist that I know has stories like that. They got rejected a lot. They kept trying to learn, though. And the key to breaking through in the end is that you try something, you go out and you submit it, you go out and you get rejected, and then you try to learn from what you did that time. You learn, and then you try something slightly different. You try something new, and you keep doing that. And the people who go through that process of trying something, failing at it, but learning from it, and then going back again, the people who are relentless about that, they tend to break through.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Nice end note, right? Yeah, right.